Welcome to the podcast series, Ascendem, brought to you by Heidelberg University's Graduate School for Humanities and Social Sciences. Tune in for thought-provoking interviews with experts in different fields, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics. Welcome to HGG's podcast series, Ascendem. Today, we are really glad to have Maximilian Katan from the Heidelberg University of Jewish Studies. Hello, Max. Today, we are going to talk about two different titles, actually. The first one is the title of Maximilian's presentation at our Summer Forum 2025, which is Us and Them in East and West, Jewish Identity Constructions in the Habsburg Monarchy. Maximilian is also a PhD student who is pursuing his PhD title with the project titled Language, Literature and National Identities in Central Europe. So, starting from these informations, Maximilian, traditionally we ask our guests to give more information about their background, in which also you can provide us a little bit of your motivation. Why did you choose these topics for our summer forum and also as a PhD project?
Thank you for the kind introduction, Sinan. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk a bit about my research. And yes, so I was initially trained as a historian at the University of Vienna, but I also pursued a degree in German studies. So those two are my sort of departure points academically. And because I was confronted many times with topics sort of from or about Jewish history, I began delving a bit deeper into that, and I ended up pursuing an MA in Jewish studies, both in Stockholm and Heidelberg. The overall framework of my PhD thesis more or less combines all these, different disciplines. So there's an historical aspect, but as literary sources are an important resource for me, also that comes into play, and obviously because it's set in a framework of Jewish history, the Jewish studies aspects are also important.
But just for clarity, have you always actually concentrated on the Jewish studies in different universities that you named also Stockholm, Berlin, Heidelberg and Vienna, I guess?
Yes. No, not specifically. It was just something that happened, I would say. Yeah, for me, it was a very, fruitful encounter.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. So let's a little bit concentrate on your actual research topic, and they were both about actually Habsburg monarchy. And maybe it would be a broad question, but what were the factors actually that made you to examine Habsburg monarchy in specific? So maybe because it's an empire that attracted you, or any other reasons, what was the actual motivation?
I mean, an easy explanation would be that coming from Vienna, I'm biographically linked to a sort of post-imperial space, and understanding its history through this very specific lens was something that sparked my interest. There's a lot of very fascinating research also coming up in the present. So I feel that it's a field that is ever changing and remains interesting. But there are also not blind spots, but maybe fields that are less sort of researched, and especially when it comes to combining interdisciplinary approaches, which is something that also the HGGS tries to emphasize, and I'm happy to be a member at that point. And I think this interdisciplinary approach can also lead to new insights.
On that point, maybe to more delve on this interdisciplinary working methodology, what were these different disciplines that you are trying to combine actually in your research when trying to examine this historical period in Habsburg Empire?
So broadly speaking, I would say it's history, then literary / German studies, and last but not least, Jewish studies. But one can ask whether it's a sort of discipline of its own or
Yeah. And we are going to also restrict ourselves in a specific period in the Habsburg monarchy, which is the late 19th century and the 20th century. And you also emphasized the importance of these dynamics, these changing dynamics, actually immanent maybe in the context of the empires, because it composes this multi-diversity in terms of nations, in terms of religions. When we are talking about empires, by definition, it has these elements in it. So maybe when comparing with the other periods of the Habsburg monarchy, what attracted your attention, especially at this period, in this period of this empire, of the Austrian Empire or Habsburg monarchy?
So very good questions. What sparked my interest here was that this specific time period between 1848 and 1914, it somewhat marks, not a catastrophe, more like a dramatical term, but we are in a time that is very rapidly changing, both politically but also socially, where technical developments lead to sort of increasing modernization, but you also have developments that go hand in hand. And this all leading up to like the great catastrophe of the First World War is something that I found to be very interesting and also sadly relevant when looking at present times. Yes.
Actually, we are also going to concentrate on two different writers that you placed at the heart of your research. The first one is Carl Emil Franzos, and the second one is Nathan Birnbaum. I'm really sorry if I pronounce these names a little bit in a wrong way. But first of all, as you explained, you are also a researcher in the field of Jewish studies. Both of these authors are coming from a Jewish background. And apart from maybe their Jewish heritage, what made you appeal to those writers? I'm asking this question because there are a lot of Jewish writers at this period. So what made these two authors different from the other ones maybe at this period?
Okay, so what made them particularly interesting for me was that they are not as known and well-researched as, I don't know, Kafka and Stefan Zweig. Even in my first proposal, I was thinking about including Stefan Zweig, but then ended up not doing that because there's a lot of very good scholarship on his work. So only trying to get a glimpse of what there is that has not been said would have been an issue time-wise. And I just ended up thinking that comparing these two might be interesting enough in itself because, as you said, they both come from a Jewish background. But they have very different approaches to what to do with this sort of background. So one aim of the thesis is also to show internal diversity within a minority culture and to show that also on a personal level comparing two individuals, two authors.
Actually, you also mentioned that these two authors, these two writers are coming from really different backgrounds and they lived in different time frames and they have distinctively a really different political stance, actually. Yeah. One is Carl Emil Franzos, please correct me if I say it wrong, but I think has more liberal approaches in terms of politics, at least for the German unification, because he has this ideal of having a liberal German state in which freedom can also be more fostered. And Nathan Birnbaum has a different stance, actually, and if I also interpret it correctly, he is more connected to the Jewish community that he is living in, or maybe the Jewish diaspora globally. Mm. So what are the patterns that connects actually these two writers, or are you planning to compare them actually with each other in terms of political stance? I mean, how do you connect these two writers from different backgrounds?
I mean, it's a very good question because I cannot attest anyhow through the sources that they ever met personally. Maybe in short, so Carl Emil Franzos was born in 1848. It's not quite clear because in his biographical text, there are only three available. He writes that he was born in 1848 in Podolia, so across the border on the Tsarist Russian side. But if you look at sort of official documents in archives, you would find 1847 as his date of birth, and Chotkiv as the city. It's not quite clear. It could be that it's an administrational error. Those happened. It could also be that in his biographical accounts, he inscribed himself in history of revolutionary uprising, because 1848 obviously is not just some year, it's the year of revolutions in Europe. And if one looks at Franz Rüssel's later, or so like political activism, it makes a lot of sense to become part of this history. So he was born in the very eastern parts of the Habsburg monarchy in Galicia, as the son of an assimilated German-speaking physician. In 1848, so the father's generation, still many bourgeois Jewish individuals, they saw German culture or the attachment to it as a way of securing, how to say, a pathway into a liberal future. And Francis is very much influenced by that. Then after his father dies, he dies when he's about 11 years old only. The family relocates to Chernowitz, which is nowadays Chernivtsi in western Ukraine. He visits actually the only German-speaking gymnasium or secondary school in Bukovina. It was the province then. And for him, this sort of embodies the sort of ideal standard of liberal, quasi-egalitarian coexistence of various national identities, but also religious ones. And if you then look at Nathan Birnbaum, who was born in 1864, so like around about 20 years later, he has a very different biographical background. So his parents, they come from what is now the Czech Republic. They moved to Vienna, the imperial capital, and they envision for their son like a classical, how to say, Stiegsgeschichte, like he would become part of this liberal bourgeoisie in Vienna through visiting a German-speaking school and studying at a university. But Birnbaum rejects this vision, and he actually sort of denies the validity of trying to assimilate to German culture and thus solving issues of political representation and or battling anti-Semitism, which is on the rise. So yeah, maybe one can explain these differences through the time between the dates of birth of the two, but there are many more factors in play. And yes, I try to bring them together.
And maybe other question, you also mentioned about the different factors, and you named one of the factors as time. Is spatial relationships, I mean, the place, the cities that these authors lived in, maybe they also played a factor. Would that be a correct interpretation?
Obviously. So that's definitely a key factor there. But if you take, for instance, Birnbaum, he was part of like student circles, and he then met many people coming from more eastern parts of Europe, because he actually, like, he was born in Vienna, right? So he is not from the east, Franzos is, and Birnbaum then decides to move to Chernivtsi, whereas Franzos goes the other way. He goes to Vienna and then to Graz and Berlin. So yes, so that was something that I found super interesting, because they actually reverse their ways.
Actually, yeah, that's really interesting, because they chose to not to be part of the culture that they should also be grown up in this culture, but they rejected some ideas. Maybe that was something that connecting these two different actors, maybe. I'm not sure.
No, that's, I think, a valid interpretation. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And also, nationalism was a part of your research project. And when we are talking about empires, we always, in the high schools or in the elementary schools, learn this stereotypical information that, okay, one of the main reasons why empires failed at the late 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century is that the rise of nationalism. Mm-hmm. And also, again, stereotypically with the influence of the French Revolution and so on. Can we also talk about the same role of nationalism in that period? And if that's the case, actually, how these writers interpreted nationalism and why also maybe in a broader sense plays a role in your research about these two authors?
So it's a very fascinating but also complex topic, I would say, because sort of more traditional scholarship, it would align with what you just outlined, this idea that the strive for national independence, it inevitably led to the collapse of empires, which is obviously too fatalistic. And if one looks at the newer scholarship, for instance, if you look at Peter Judson's analysis of the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, it's more or less agreed on nowadays that nationalism and empire do not necessarily sort of contradict one another. So there is the possibility of coexistence. Obviously, there's also the potential for friction, and there has been. But this idea that one sort of excludes the other does not really work within this concrete sort of political and historical frame. But obviously, in the sort of beginning of the second half of the 19th century, it is a challenge to the structures of the empire, and the question how to answer this challenge is on the table.
And can we also find clues about how to answer this challenge of nationalism in the works of two different authors?
In the works themselves, I'm not too sure. But if you look at the political history, obviously, when Austria loses the war with Prussia, and they have to compromise with Hungary and build a sort of dual monarchy as a structure reforming the empire, there you could see one way of dealing with this challenge structurally. And then maybe that I can relate to the works of Francis, for instance. You obviously have responses to this restructuring. So Francis, for instance, he was very much against the way this compromise with Hungary was constructed, be it because him being a more or less German nationalist, he would have envisioned a different state. But yeah, also I wouldn't be too sure if he would himself call himself a nationalist. So if we now look at his sort of activism and his works, obviously one would think of that, but not too sure if it would be a self-proclaimed attribute.
Then with what you said, actually, is the definition of nationalism plays an important role here. And in your research, you are also having this quote or analysis of Robert A. Kahn, in which Jewish nationalism is not a part of his analysis, which in no way maybe aligns with the reality. So how do they consider the definition of nationalism in that context, and how do we have any clues, any indices, any mentioning in the works of these authors? How do they affected by this nationalistic movements and also from the different definition of nationalism maybe?
So maybe it's important to say that sort of Kahn, he would follow this traditional approach to nations, or the strive for national independence poses a challenge for the empire. And I think so when he's analyzing different national groups striving for that independence within the empire, he might have excluded Jewish nationalism because it was not inherently linked to territorial claims within the empire. So, and if one looks at, for instance, Nathan Birnbaum, his nationalism is more or less a vision of cultural autonomy. That is something different from nationalism that is based on territorial claims or links sort of the idea of a unity of language community and the territory historically. So that's different. And it's maybe also less threatening for a state. So that's one possible cause for excluding it. The other could be the complicated way of grasping Jewishness as either a religion, but religion itself is a very complex construct, right? Stemming from at least in our discourses, more or less Western European conception of belief, whereas politics is another sphere, and that's hard to align here. So yeah, there are many factors that make this a very complicated one. Maybe one thing we did not yet talk about, but that's very important, is language, because in the Habsburg Empire, your national belonging or your nationality would have been declared through your language of daily usage. So were you to speak Hungarian as your language of daily usage, you are Hungarian. If you speak Ukrainian, that was the old sort of term for Ukrainian, you were Ukrainian. But there was no way of declaring yourself Jewish by a nation, because there was no language that was accepted as a national language of a Jewish nation. So that's something Nathan Birnbaum tried to change by turning to Yiddish. That was the language of daily usage of the majority of the Jews living in the eastern crown lands of the monarchy. Yeah.
And when we are actually talking about the situation in the Habsburg Empire, we cannot just exclude or we cannot just ignore the fact that the anti-Semitism was in a great rise in that period. So would you like to elaborate on the effects of the increase in the extent of anti-Semitism in that period to both these writers?
Yes. So if one looks at Calimene Francis, for instance, that is a big problem for his political program, because many of those anti-Semitic agitations, they actually came from his beloved German side. So we can see, if he sees, say, anti-Semitism from, like, in his works, if we have a badly painted figure of a Ruthenian clerk, he has no problem addressing his anti-Semitism and criticizing it. But it becomes more complex when he's describing German figures. That's also something that is quite complex to ask. What does it mean to be a German in the Habsburg monarchy in the 19th century? But yeah, it's also something that I can and I try to analyze through, like, historical sources. So I was looking at stenographic protocols of the Diet of Bukovina in Chernivtsi, and there you can see there was a Jewish party. And they had various alliances with Ukrainian parties, and there were also influential Romanian parties. And these alliances, they change. And at the end of the 19th century, using anti-Semitism also in a political framework, it becomes a powerful tool. And it's also used as such. So you can see that, for instance, in the speeches of Dr. Aurel Onchul, he was a Romanian politician. There's a great article written by Andrei Corbehoishi about this man. And yeah, you can also see that in historical sources. And you can see a struggle in the literary works of Franzos, how to deal with this development, and B, also how to integrate it in his own worldview. Because when he moves to Berlin, he, or as a young author, he describes Chernivtsi as a, and I quote, Vorhof, which is like a courtyard of the paradise Germany. And when he moves to this envisioned paradise, he encounters a lot of anti-Semitism and is basically isolated. And that must have been a very tough situation.
The other aspect that also affected these two writers, we also mentioned where they lived, but specifically we can also categorize where they lived as Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. That would be the correct interpretation of the categorization, I guess. And they also really seem to be affected from where they lived. And I'm quoting there your analysis from Franzos' life, that he was living in a liminal space where Europe and Asia blend, a region of cultural tensions. I guess that was the interpretation of François about where he was living. So it also creates a dichotomy, actually, in their mindset between Europe and Asia. They were also coming with some distinctions about these two regions. Would you like to elaborate on that topic a little bit?
Yes, with pleasure. So, I mean, this ideal dichotomy is nothing new. It's a very old one. And why is Francis interesting when it comes to that? I think because he somewhat breaks this binary by introducing the liminal space as an area where both meet and interact. And what he also does, and that's, I think, very interesting, is he says it's not a geographical boundary. So it's not like there is a line dividing both spheres or sort of delineating what this liminal space is. But you have, how to say, if you take a train from Vienna to Chernivtsi, you would pass Europe, half Asia. I mean, obviously, it's also very problematic characterization. But at that time, and even nowadays, if you look at more recent scholarship, maybe by Larry Wolf, he also describes Eastern Europe as a quasi demi-Orient that is not super far away from this idea of half Asia as a meeting space, albeit obviously used in polemical terms by Francis for a German-speaking Western European audience.
I would like to approach your historical background, actually, as a discipline, and that would be a methodological question, because when we are talking about two personalities here, one aspect that you would like to concentrate on your research is to get the mindset of these two authors exactly. And in order to do that, you have to understand the soul of nature, the zeitgeist of that time exactly, and also the places they were lived in. And what are the methodological challenges that you are facing with as a historian? I'm pretty sure that because you have a background also in the discipline of history that is helping you with this interdisciplinary research. But at the same time, it's not really easy to find a way between subjectivity of the authors and the objectivity. And it's also possible to question this objectivity, whether there's a objective information that we can always rely on. And as a historian, maybe, what would you like to say about these challenges?
I mean, I would say it's highly questionable if the literary texts by Francis especially are trustworthy historical sources. I have to ask this question because the reliable information is scarce, and it's also not what contemporaries use to inform themselves. So Francis, he wrote fictional works, he wrote novels, he wrote novellas, but he also wrote a lot for newspapers in feuilletons. Many people knew him as a feuilletonist, so they would read his texts in a Neue Freie Presse. And what he does in both his fictional and quasi-factual writing is he mixes fact and fiction. So as a historian, it's very hard to grasp this methodologically. There I have to employ also methods from the literary sciences. And as you said, like, I would have to approach the persons very closely to understand their way of thinking. That's one thing, but I also try to analyze what effect their writing had on their supposed audiences. So it's less the question, is what he writes true, but how does it affect public opinion? And how is this public opinion formed in the first place?
A follow-up question in the framework of methodology. Francis has a background in journalism, and he describes himself as a journalist. So does that help you in terms of the information that he provided, or his journalism is also a bit a mix of maybe fact and fiction?
I'm not sure. So he's a lawyer by training, actually, but the feuilleton part of newspapers especially is a tricky field because it's not as like we would see proper journalism today as being objective and influenced by, how to say, the reasoning between pro and contra. It can and does convey a political ideology. That's the good thing. He's very transparent about that. So he says, okay, my my writing has a political agenda, and that I can use. I have a lot of ego documents, sort of where he himself sort of contextualizes his writing, and that's something that helps me. But yeah, it gets complicated on other points.
They were also producing a lot of works in the literature, both of the authors. So what were your favorite ones personally? I mean, not in terms of the academic research, but what were the works that most touched you maybe in the framework of your research?
I mean, what I found very interesting is that if you read Francis's early works, you can see a very harsh critique of traditional Jewish milieus. It's very hard to say. If you read it now, it feels a bit maybe too harsh. Sort of with time, his views and depictions, they become a bit more emphatic also, less one-dimensional, and also the figures, they change, they become more nuanced. So I would say my favorite would probably be his sort of opus magnum. It's called Der Poyatz. It was published posthumously. It's also a question why he didn't publish it while he was alive. That's obviously also connected to the history of antisemitism. And there's another novel that is very interesting. It's called Moschko von Parma. And it's the history of the story of a Jewish soldier, actually, that fought in Italy and comes back to his hometown. It's, yeah, very interesting one. Another challenge that I didn't talk about is that Nathan Birnbaum, for instance, he was not primarily a writer. He was actually a political activist. So most of his writing is not fictional. So I'm comparing also two authors that had very different styles of writing. And that's yet another challenge that I'm trying to resolve.
First of all, thank you for your wonderful recommendations. And second of all, we wish you good luck with all the challenges, with overcoming all of the challenges that you are facing right now. And our listeners also would find this interview really insightful, really informative. And as a tradition, I would like to ask you one personal question from your life, except for your academic life, which is that you also organized an event titled Wund is Mein Herz. I think the correct English translation would be My Heart is Wounded.
Yeah.
And how was that event actually? What were your aim at this event? And are you planning to do these kind of events in the future, maybe under the umbrella of Heidelberg University of Jewish Studies? So what is your future plans actually, apart from your academic life?
It's a very good question. So the event that you were talking about, it was a cooperation between a theater collective called Akkad Theater, and they planned at that time a play about Selma Meerbaum, who was a Jewish lyricist, also born in Chernivtsi. She was killed very young in a German camp. Their idea was to put her on a stage in Germany, and also to give room for her lyrical works, which are very interesting and worth reading. So they wanted to cooperate and make an event. And so what we did is we invited Marion Tauschwitz. She's actually a biographer of Selma Meerbaum, and she's based in Heidelberg. So we invited her and a few actors, and we had a very wonderful biographical/lyrical/musical event honoring the works of Selma Meerbaum.
I would say another interdisciplinary event then.
Of course. And hopefully more of them are to come in the future. And you are all very welcome to join.
That's great. Thank you so much, Max.
Thank you.
So we are concluding right now our podcast episode. If you liked our episode, please don't forget to subscribe our channel and also listen our previous episodes. And me and Max are saying goodbye to you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. you for listening to the HGGS podcast series, Asandem. In this series, we bring you conversations with experts from a wide range of disciplines, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics. If you enjoyed our podcast, we invite you to explore our previous episodes and subscribe to our channel so you never miss a new episode. Stay tuned for more insightful interviews coming soon.